Thank you. So for those of you who were here yesterday, you'll recall that I told you primarily about what the cell types in the hippocampus, in the greater hippocampal formation did, and used that to support some of the ideas about how the hippocampal operates as a spatial memory system and as a spatial navigation system. What I left out of the story is one of the major aspects of hippocampal physiology, which is the role that's played by the LFP theta oscillations in the hippocampus. And that's the primary goal of my talk today, is to sort of try to see if we can integrate that into the overall story and to see what that those oscillations do for hippocampal physiology. And the short story, the bottom line, is that they provide a timing signal against which the timing of the firing of the spikes is measured. And that operates to provide a temporal code. And I guess that's one of the best examples of the way in which the nervous system can use the timing of spikes to provide information about things in the outside world. There are other examples, but this is still, I think, one of the most robust and resilient examples. So yesterday I told you that we did a lot of the work in the hippocampus. Here are our electrodes in the CA1 field. And much of the work that's done in this area is done in two-dimensional environments, or as Kate will have told you now, in three-dimensional environments, in which animals run around in these boxes. But a lot of the work that I'm going to tell you about is done on a one-dimensional environment, a linear track. And I'll describe this a little bit more in detail, but essentially it just gets the animal to run back and forth between two walls which have food on it so that it can be rewarded. And what this does is, it's not a completely neutral or version of this, because it does change some of the aspects of the place cell physiology. But it gives you the opportunity to get lots and lots of data. And for a lot of this work, we need lots of data. And you can find place cells on a linear track. I should point out that they're different. In general, place cells in two-dimensional environments, shown here, are actually direction-free. They're independent of the direction that the animal is heading, so that it makes little difference if the animal is moving north or south or east or west through the field. Whereas on a linear track, they tend to be directional. And I don't know, maybe Mayank has a explanation for this, but we really don't understand why that is the case. And it's an important observation, and there are some situations in which that's not true. You sometimes find cells which fire in both directions, but by and large, the cells fire in only one direction on the linear track. And as I say, I'm going to spend most of my time trying to integrate this LFP signal, the 8 to 10 hertz oscillatory signal that's a very, very prominent part and a very large signal in hippocampus and in hippocampal formation in general. Okay, so remember I told you that there are different cell types. There are place cells, grid cells, head direction cells, and these boundary vector cells, which we think provide the information which the animal brain extracts from the environment that can be used to create place cells and also to tell the animal where it is. As I say, for a long time, in fact, well before we or anybody else had started working on the hippocampus, it was known that one of the prominent signals in hippocampal physiology was this LFP theta activity. And it was discovered in about mid-1930s. For a long time, it was thought to be an artifact. Brains don't oscillate. And so it was really quite a long time before it was accepted that this was a true physiological signal. And some of the best work about the behavioral correlate of this signal was done by Case van der Wolf, who was a Canadian working in Western Ontario. And he did it in the rat. Up until this point, it was really quite difficult for people to come to any agreement about the behavioral correlates of this oscillatory activity. So you can see it here. here's an animal running around, and you can see this very nice sinusoidal, as I say, they're right about 7 to 10 hertz oscillation. Looking for all intents, and sometimes it looks like a sawtooth, but quite often it actually looks like a sinusoid. Well, what Case did was spent in terminal hours, these are the days before any automatic recording techniques, looking at the animal and watching a polygraph trace of this potential, and trying to see if he could make some sense of what the relationship between the behavior and the potential was. And what he noticed was, first of all, that they really are three states, but we now think of them mostly as two states of the hippocampal, gross hippocampal physiology. There's the theta activity here, and then there's this less synchronized potential with a broader spectrum and clearly less rhythmic and less organized potential, which he called LIA, and we still call it that large irregular amplitude activity. And sometimes during this you see these sharp waves here shown like this, and they're all the whole physiology which is related to that, and a lot of the replay and preplay phenomenon which you'll hear later on in this meeting is related to that to those oscillations, those potentials. I won't say anything more about them. But I want to concentrate on this theta activity here. Because what you can see is that if you just look at all of the various behaviors that are shown here, from sitting still and making small movements, and I don't think he has it here, but things like eating or drinking or more ingestive types of behaviors, that's when you get this non-theta, if I can call it that, LIA behavior. Whereas whenever the animal starts to move relative to the environment, and Randolph called them voluntary movements, but I think the simplest description is whenever he's doing anything which moves his location relative to the environment, translational or rotational behaviors, then you begin to get this theta activity. So if he's swimming, it doesn't really make any difference what the behavior, how the behavior actually manifests itself in muscle activity, as long as he's moving around. So if he's squirming while you're picking him up, or you're placing him in the water and he swims around, if he jumps out of a box, then you get it during either a small jump or a large jump. And in fact, there's a relationship between the frequency of the amplitude of the theta and the height of the jump. And that was one of the first observations, that there was some relationship between some aspects of this wave and some aspects of movement. It wasn't just a correlation, gross correlation. There is a relationship. And in fact, it turns out, and I won't say much about this, that the frequency tends to be a function of speed of movement. Okay, well, you can do this a little bit more systematically. You can put an animal on a linear track and just look at some aspect of movement, such as the speed running down the track. And you can see that when he's sitting at one end and eating, you get this irregular large LIA potential. As he starts to run, you get this beautiful sinusoid. And then when he stops to eat at the other end, sometimes you get a little bit of carryover, but then it begins to break up. Okay, for a long time, people like Yuri Buzak. Sorry?
What filtering do you have to do to get this?
Filtering.
Yeah. This is in the raw trace, right?
You can see it in the raw trace. This is a big signal. Does it say? No, it doesn't say. So this would easily be several hundred millivolts to half a millivolt. Several hundred microvolts to half a millivolt. So yeah, you can see it. If it were completely unfiltered trace, you would see spikes riding on that, but you could still see this oscillation. It's a big, big thing. It's probably the biggest LFP potential in the rat brain, probably the biggest. Yeah. The only thing comparable is the thalamocortical oscillations that you get when the animal is sitting quietly. So the filtering, to answer your question directly, is the filters are set usually at from about something like zero of half a hertz to 20 or 30 hertz. So it's way outside the Nyquist criteria. We don't worry too much about that. It could be higher. You can go up to 50. It doesn't make much difference. There are other things in there You want to keep below. You want to keep below your noise, and you want to get rid of the gamma. So I won't say anything about the gamma, but I don't think anybody's going to say anything about gamma. So there's another potential which, in fact, is nested in with the theta, and is phase related to it, and which is very popular in the neocortex and in the olfactory system, which is gamma. And we're still struggling. We're still struggling in the hippocampus to know exactly what the correlation is.
So we showed the gamma actually changes with running speed. We wrote a couple of papers on that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that happens.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah, but the question is it just because it's actually related to the, so does the theta. So if they're related to each other.
No, this is the amplitude actually. And the phase. See, the phase of gamma precesses, which I don't want to jump the gun.
Okay. Okay.
You're going to talk about.
No, I'm not. I'm going to talk about phase precession, but I'm not going to talk about gamma. So.
Okay.
Okay. So, for many years, people like Yuri Buzaki, who's spent a large part of his life looking at doing source sync potentials and doing all kinds of mapping of the theta in the hippocampus and elsewhere, have always said to me, "Okay, Keith, what do you think the relationship is between theta?" And the and any of the spatial activity that you keep going on about. And I guess I, for a long time, believed that the relationship was something like phase locking. And that was based partly on what one sees if one looks at the interneurons, or what are called the theta cells, and looks at just the firing rate relative to the ongoing LFP. If you do that for a lot of them, it's not true for all of them, but for a lot of them, what you see is that when the animal sits quietly, like you'd expect from the LFP, the theta cells are just showing this random firing, again with the spikes firing and bursts every once in a while. But then when the animal starts to run, the activity increases in rate, and it also begins to show this very nice bursting activity, and the bursting, which you can see, I won't show any plots of this, but what you can see here is that the bursting actually shows a very nice phase relationship to the ongoing theta activity. I should say that there are all the whole zoo of interneurons in the hippocampus. I think the latest count from people like Freund and Buzaki and Somogyi, that there were something like 27 different subtypes of interneurons, which you can classify in terms of their projections, in terms of their transmitters, and so on and so forth. And most of them show this kind of relationship. Yeah.
These are single cell recordings, or
yeah, this is just single. This is just one single. In fact, this is the first cell I ever recorded from the hippocampus.
The Betch clamp.
No, it's just one extracellular recording. We can't say for absolutely sure that it's just one cell, but as far as we can tell, using the techniques we have available to us, which are extracellular tetrodes, and this was done with a single sharp electrode, but with tetrodes, we're more or less convinced that this is just a single cell. The amplitude is consistent, and so on and so forth. But you're right. I mean, if you're querying how confident you can be that using extracellular recording, looking at the potentials that are outside the cell, you can be sure that those potentials are coming from only one cell. There's always a slight, we sweep that out as a carpet. and work done around the same time, this is really quite old work in the New York lab by Steve Fox, in which they looked at the relationship between not just the theta cells, but also the place cells and the LFP, suggested that that was, in fact, right, that there was a phase-locked relationship. And they, but they did the work on a running track, on a running wheel, so the animals were placed on running wheels, and they looked at the cells, which were only firing intermittently, as you'd expect. If you take a place cell and you stick the animal onto a running wheel and let it run in place, and it's very unlikely that it's the animals in the field of that place cell, so you're not going to get the dense firing that you see when the animal runs through the field. So after many years of thinking about it, and also having noticed that, in fact, under certain circumstances, there wasn't a fixed phase. It looked to me like up until around 1990, that the phase was random. And whenever Buzaki would ask me that question, I would say to him, yeah, it just looks random to me. I don't know. I don't know what this data stuff is doing, because it just doesn't look like there's any relationship. I decided to go back and look at it.
Wait, for 23 years you thought it was random?
Actually, so I thought it was random from 1970 to 23 years. You're very quick with this math. It's really, really, really formidable. Well, actually, so there's a little bit of story there. I had actually, I wasted a lot of my career. 2 or 3 years I wasted my career working on rabbits. And there, the LFPs are about twice as large. They're easily a millivolt. And every once in a while, I would just look. This is before computers. You know, I would just look at the screen and see if I could see any phase relationship between the firing of the place cell. And it just looked random. You could fire any, you could see any phase you wanted. So I decided I'd go back and look at it. And of course, one of the things you should realize is, although I presented lots of figures of nice Gaussian place fields in two-dimensionals, that's a bit of a con, and it's a bit of an artifact of averaging. Because if you look at what happens if an animal just runs through the place field on a single trial, then what you see is that the cell doesn't go brrrr. It doesn't have that kind of fire. What it does is it goes it fires with this bursting activity. So here's an example. Here's an animal running on a linear track. Here's the speed profile. Here's the oscillations. And you can see here one, two, three, four, five place cells, and then there's one of these theta cells. And the theta cell fires along the whole of the track, whereas each of these place cells, as you'd expect, fires only over a restricted portion. But you can see each one of them is going brup, 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 brup. And in fact, you can already see that the firing rate tends to be low at the ends of the fields and then ramp up to a peak in the middle. Okay, so I thought, okay, I'm going to sit here. I had a very nice data set, and I just sat there and looked day after day at the runs through a field. I had about 2 or 3 days worth of data. And in the beginning, it made no sense at all. But eventually, it began to dawn on me that if you looked at a run on a linear track like this, most of the data came from plus mazes, but this is a better example, and you looked at the relationship between the firing of a cell and this LFP, well, you saw that the phase was in fact not constant. It was changing, but it was changing in a very systematic way. And you can almost see it right in a single run. This is a bit of a cheat. It's hard to see it in single runs. I have to make some excuse for why it took me 3 days to see this. Quite often, you can't see it on single runs because some of the spikes drop out. But if you have a good run in which the cell fires on each of the oscillations, then what you can see, as shown here, where we've marked the zero crossing, positive to negative zero crossing of the associated theta, and this is recorded from the same electrode with different filtering. So you break the signal into a low pass and high pass filters. What you can see if you look at the relationship between the firing and the cell in these ticks, is that when the animal first comes into the field, the ticks line up, but then progressively the spikes move forward on the wave. They change their phase, and when the animal is halfway through the field, the spike occurs about halfway along the wave, and it goes through a whole, in general, 360-degree oscillation on a really, really good trial. Usually it goes through less. Yeah?
Most physicists would get a little bit nervous with you assigning a phase to a fairly random signal.
Which is the random signal? This one?
Yeah.
It's totally arbitrary.
Did you try to fit a sign to that?
Okay, so I'm just giving you a little bit of history here. This is an observation. Of course, then we come in, all the mathematicians come in and they say, oh, let's fit a sine wave to this. And in fact, all of the phase relationships are done on the fitted relationship with the fitted wave.
But you use here zero crossing. So you have the mean line, and that's through zero?
So you find the zero crossings in the obvious way. Okay? So if you now say, okay, here's another example. What does all this mean? Well, let's then just plot the phase relationship to this wave, shown here, against various variables. And obviously, the first thing we're going to look at is some spatial variable, like the actual distance through the field, or the distance along the track, or whatever you want. And what you can see here for this cell, which is actually quite a nice one, is that there's a very good, really quite linear. I'm never quite sure that it's linear, but it's linear to the first approximation, and the correlation is about 0.71. Across a large number of cells, across the population, it's usually about 0.55, which in biology is pretty good. And what this means, and the reason for this, is shown on this right-hand side here, is that the cell is essentially oscillating, and it's oscillating at a higher frequency than the population LFP. And you can show that fairly easily by looking at the autocorrelation of the cell here and comparing it with the periods of the LFPs taken at the same time from the same electrode. And you can see they're different, and the cell has a slightly higher frequency than the period itself. Okay, so that's the simple explanation for what's going on, is that there are two oscillators and they're out of phase. But it turns out that, for example, the cell always tends to start firing at the same point in the LFP. So they're not just running independently of each other, they're related to each other. There's some relationship between the two oscillators. It's not as though they're totally independent of each other.
The two oscillators, one is the actual clay cells and the other one is
this wave, which we don't know what it is, but we think it's probably representing some sort of gross oscillatory activity across the whole population, probably membrane potential oscillations, firing of cells, all sorts of things. But they must all be synchronized in some way, or at least be related to each other, because they do some to this exercise.
I'm just trying potential. To distinguish. When you say that the oscillator is slightly ahead, is that distinct from the statement that phase depends on position? Because if the particle
it's the
moves,
same thing.
It's the same thing, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Well, it can be the same thing if the phase takes into account things like speed.
Yeah, if it moves.
It's exactly what Ketchin was saying. There has to be that fixed relationship. It has to take the speed.
What happens if the rat stops in the middle of a place field and then keeps going?
It's a bugger. Another failed experiment. Good question. So it's a good question. I mean, I've tried, actually, and to get the animals to do that, to stop. Dead. And it's not enough data, right? So you need to. So I tried training very hard, training animals to sort of stop, turning a tone on and get them to stop and then stay still. What they do is they stop and they start mooching around, thinking, all right, when are you going to let me go again, and all that sort of stuff. And
but that's just fine. Because you want to plot versus the position, so they keep just messing around and keep going.
I'll tell you what I think happens, but don't quote me. I think you get a temple, slow temple reset of the system, but I'm not sure. And then the phase precession then actually accelerates through the rest of the field. But without good data, but it's a good experiment and it's one that should be done. Because it speaks to the whole question of whether it's internal dynamics or whether it's imposed from the outside. I'll just say a little bit about that. Yeah,
mine. I mean, you have stronger correlation with position than time, right?
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. So then of course you really have to talk a little bit about what else. If you just look at position, then that's what you're going to see. Okay. But if you look at other things like time, and you can pick the time to start, or the firing rate, and this is, of course is controversial because. And I think Mayank is one of the people who believes this, is that there's a better correlation or a good correlation with firing rate than we found. But under certain circumstances, we're pretty sure that we can uncouple the instantaneous firing rate from the phase shift. and these are the population data. So this is controversial. I think we'll stand by our statement that the correlation is best with position and less good with firing rate. There can't be a complete uncoupling between firing rate, the cell has to fire, and so on and so on. If it fires too much, so there has to be some relationship, but it's a very, very loose tenuous one.
Is this always measured with linear correlation? Because it seems like a lot of these are sort of...
So this is all, this is all linear correlation. So it won't, if you want to come back and look at something else, quadratics or something else like that, then it might, something might come there. But yeah, so there is, you might want to fit this with something other than this, or some people think that this might be two curves, one which shows a very nice precession here, and then something going going awry at the end. So there's still a lot of,
Sorry to bring you back, but the LFP signal, which you said you believe the frequency changes with speed.
Yeah.
Is that a linear relationship itself, you believe?
I haven't included that in, but yeah, it's pretty linear, yeah. It's very linear. And that's an important. It's got to be some. It doesn't have to be perfectly linear, but it's got to be some function of sorry.
Several groups, us as well as McNaughton group, has shown that precession is quite non-linear.
Yeah.
It goes straight, and then at the end there is very little.
There's something funny going on here. Yeah, but you can still show that there's a very good. This is still a very good linear fit. So you know, unless you've got some idea of why it's non-linear, what's happening here.
We have a paper 10 years ago that you don't like.
Mayek and I don't agree on this. This is the red rag to the bull here. Okay, well, thinking about this, it seemed that there were, and Mayek will give you another version of how you can do this, but one possible way in which you can produce this phenomenon is to think that there are several oscillators, as Ketchin said, with different frequencies. And one instantiation of this, but it's not the only way of doing it, is that the two oscillators actually are impinging on the same cell.
Was this ruled out by Remy's neuron paper?
The fact that it's, you mean that it's a single oscillator, you mean that because that you, that the space constant is such that you would begin to get synchronization.
Then rule out two oscillators.
No, it just rules out that this is a standard, that you can use a standard model of the neuron and apply it to it. You could use all sorts of rather more sophisticated, which with for example, filters in one direction, not the other, right?
But anybody ever done this with the neuron model?
No. So right now, and I'm not wedded to this. It's just an easy way of explaining it. I guess the simplest question is whether you can have two independent oscillators in one cell without given the biophysics of the cell without them phase locking into each other. And I guess the question is also how long. That process takes place. We're talking about a very short, we're talking about a couple of cycles in the oscillator. And the question is how long it would be before they would begin to sync. But I'm not wedded to the standard model of the neuron, and this might actually be. So what this is suggesting then is that if you had two oscillators, and let's assume for the time being that they're not in the same cell, with different frequencies, and you added them together, what you would get would be this this interference pattern, where the overall envelope of the interference pattern is given by the difference between the two waves, and the internal oscillations are given by the average of the two oscillations. And that would, if that were the case, that would explain quite a bit about of the phenomenon that we actually see on the linear track. It would explain, for example, it would explain the phase precession effect if you assume that one of the oscillators was actually represented by that extracellular LFP theta, say this one, and that the second oscillator was impinging on the cell or part of the cell dynamics itself. So, and that what you were doing when you were looking at the spikes, then that what the cell was actually spiking as a function of some exceeding a threshold of this this internal membrane potential oscillation, such that whenever this internal wave actually exceeded a threshold, that produced a spike. And as it increased in amplitude above that threshold, that produced several spikes. And if you then compare the peaks of this internal membrane potential and the soma potential, what you see is that the peaks of these internal oscillations move relative to this external LFP. What's nice about this is it actually produces an effect which Mayank doesn't like and has an alternative model for, which is that it causes the cell, the spikes of the cell to actually precess relative to this second wave, despite the fact that the amplitude of the firing is increasing and then decreasing. So if you have a simple model in which the movement of the cell relative to the external LFP is being driven by some internal potential, which is just forcing the firing forward and then relaxing again, you have to explain why it continues, the cell continues to precess despite the fact that there is a reduction in firing.
Since you mentioned, the answer is right at the bottom in your slide. That looks symmetric to me. That looks like an asymmetric ramp, which is what was the kind of main finding of the paper, right? It doesn't just wax and wane, it ramps up and then drops rather abruptly, unlike the model.
How abruptly is that? It looks, you see that as abruptly. I see, I see. I think you see that as abruptly. I even see it as well.
So if you look at the paper, that was the main claim in the abstract.
In Harvey's paper.
That's right. That's exactly the paper. It's highly.
Yes. So there certainly is the case that this model doesn't take into account any change in the DC potential. But it certainly, on the other hand, what this paper does show is that in fact the internal membrane potential oscillations actually do precess relative to this external field potential, which is not true in your model.
Well, it's true, actually. Absolutely.
I don't see how it's true. It's not true. And in fact, in fact, the firing of the spikes occur on the peaks of the internal membrane potential oscillation. Yeah.
Just a slightly different question. Suppose that you take an actual recording of the theta rhythm.
Yeah.
So you have here this beautiful beat picture, but suppose you take an actual recording of the theta rhythm for either the blue or the red, right? And then you.
Well, that would be very nice, except that one of them is supposed to be inside the cell. So
suppose you take an actual recording of the theta rhythm.
Yeah.
And also a recording of a play cell before the red starts to move, right? And then you imagine that can you generate similar beautiful beats by taking actual recordings from the theta cell and the play cell? Can you generate beats of this sort? Because these are highly idealized sinusoidal waves.
Yes. And of course, one of the arguments against this model is that these oscillations are going to be much noisier.
As you pointed out, there's two sorts of noise. The noise which spoils the phase and the noise which just changes the amplitude. And the second one is not going to spoil the picture, and the first one is. So hence my question. If you take an actual recording from... Let me rephrase it. Suppose you take an actual recording of the theta rhythm and one of the play cells. How close is the phase relationship? Is the noise in the phase sufficient to allow...
Are you talking about the data that we already have where we're recording extra cells?
Recordings of the theta rhythm and play cells and see if you can produce from such recordings an interference pattern.
You mean an intracellular recording?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so there's just very little data on that. And in fact, it's one of the reasons that we've set up the virtual reality is to be able to actually...
Membrane of the play cells and compare that with the theta rhythm.
Yes.
Do you think you then will get beats?
Yes, well, that's what the model predicts.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what the model predicts.
The data are not yet available.
Not really. So this, okay, so the data from Harvey et al. Are about the best that.
But those are petrol data, right?
No, these are intracellular. These are the intracellular data.
Okay, so then you, in principle, you could take that, put it together with a theta rhythm, and see if you still have an interference or a beat pattern as you hope for.
Yeah.
So the thing is outside the place of the completely out of phase. Only the coupling happens within the place field, and that's where...
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. So you, in principle, if you could record from inside the cell, combine that with the theta rhythm, then that should predict a beat pattern for the LFP with the tetrode outside the cell. But and then you could test this idea.
You could, well, that depends on how correlated the noise and the two frequencies are. If they're correlated,
I understand, but the question is, can one experimentally test this idea? Is the noise so bad that it's going to spoil the appearance of beats because it spoils the phase, or is it merely going to make the amplitude, in which case this picture would survive? And it's an experimental question.
I've done that extensively, not with the intracellular data, but I've done simulations where you apply different, so for the dendritic frequencies, you assume like correlations between 0 and 1. If they're perfectly correlated, you get to see the beat.
It's not a theoretical question I'm asking. I'm asking experimentally. If you do this experiment,
Robin, experimentally, it's not possible to measure.
There's
dendritic
no dendritic
potential.
Recording.
You don't have
no,
to.
No.
You would have to assume that the LFP is the dendritic.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Which is an assumption.
Yeah. But then you need to take an intracellular recording and compare it with the theta rhythm, and then see how that agrees with the LFP.
Yeah. So the first run that was done by in Tank's lab by Harvey et al. Really did a very simple thing. Just record the LFP, the MPL, the intracellular membrane potential oscillation, and then look. And this is what they saw essentially. This is a schematic of what they saw. And they saw two things. One, which is that there are these internal oscillations in the membrane potential, which shift relative to the external.
So the blue line is a membrane.
So this is the blue line is actually the external external.
That's a beautiful sine wave.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a cartoon. This is a cartoon.
This looks idealized.
This is a cartoon which represents. That's a very nice sinus wave. They're good experiments.
Very narrow frequency.
And this is also a very idealized result.
But this looks suspicious, right?
Right.
I mean, you can't take that serious. That sign.
No, because it represents. No, it represents what they actually. Again, I probably have some data.
I don't.
But what they did also find, which is dear to Mayank's heart, is that there is which is not predicted by this model, is that there's a depolarizing shift, which pushes the membrane potential closer to the firing threshold, and that then on top of that, the cells are synchronized with the oscillations. So it's a kind of, and what they've suggested for this and for the granules, for the grid cells, is that we're probably looking at some sort of a hybrid model which actually takes into account components of the various models.
So John, would not this model also predict a starting correlation between phase position and time? This is a time-based thing, right?
No, because what I didn't mention, and I'm just about to mention, is that one of these oscillators, the frequency is modulated by the animal speed. As I said yesterday, that the whole of
the omega t is you mean omega x.
Yeah, yeah. So the whole way in which you actually control for turn it from a temporal signal into a spatial signal is actually to modulate one of the oscillators, make it into a voltage or a velocity controlled oscillator so that it's actually changing its frequency as a function of the animal speed. And if you get that relationship right, then you can correct for different ones. And that's one of the things you see. One of the most impressive things about running lots and lots of trials is you see that the actual relationship between time is much, much worse because the phase precession takes into account the speed, the different speeds. And you get the same phase precession essentially if the animal runs very, very slow to the field and very rapidly. Yeah.
Would it matter which dendrite the other?
Well, I don't want to go. I don't want to go too much into the dendrite because I think there is, you know, the biophysicists and modelers don't like it because it's really quite difficult to reduce this two different oscillators of different frequencies in the same shot. Maybe the models are wrong. This is more of their stuff. And this is essentially just showing what I just said. Okay, so there are lots of problems with this model, and you've already heard most of them. I'll tell you a couple more. One is that just very soon after this was done, Yuzaki had one of his very good students, Mikhail Zugaro, do a rather important experiment in which he, as the animal was running through the field, they injected a large pulse of current into the hippocampus, which effectively has blocks all of the activity in the hippocampus. So this is the physiological analog to what you were suggesting here, and then try to see what happens. And so they wanted to see whether in fact this idea that there's an internal dynamical oscillation going on survived if you blocked it and essentially reset it. And what happened was, surprisingly, now this was an input into the hippocampus from in fact the other hippocampus. What happened was that the phase precession carried on merrily along, despite the fact that they had shut down activity for about 200 milliseconds. So that it looked as though the simple idea that there was an internal oscillator which was just carrying on and producing the phase precession wasn't going to hold up. Suggesting that maybe the oscillations were, at the very least, at least one of the oscillators was coming from somewhere outside of the cells. Equally important to my mind, and this always bothers, is that there are, in fact, multiple fields. This model predicts that there should be multiple fields because there's no reason to think that there's anything particular privileged about this little wavelet here as opposed to this little wavelet and so on and so forth. And what we did is assume that there was some extra input which was actually selecting for this little wavelet, perhaps causing the oscillator only to change frequency at this point. And as mentioned, one simple model is that outside of the place field, these two are, in fact, running at the same frequency but 180 degrees out of phase, so they cancel each other. And it's only when something else comes in and says, oh, you're now entering the place field, you know, deus ex machina fashion, but perhaps the environmental cues.
That's what the tank paper showed, right? Hmm? They showed that they were.
That's what they showed, yeah. That's what they showed. But it still is kind of, you know, at this stage. And of course, when you see these multiple oscillations, and then you think, well, okay, you have to restrict it for the place field, but if you had multiple oscillations like this, they would fit very nicely for the grid cells. And the minute that we saw the grid cells, Neil Burgess and Caswell Barry and I decided to expand the model and to change the model so that it fit not only for the place cells, but also for the grid cells. The grid cells also show phase precession. And the simplest way to expand the model is to assume that these oscillators are not only controlled by the speed at which the animal is running, but also each oscillator is controlled by the direction in which the animal is running. So that you get each of the oscillators is actually signaling how close the animal's direct heading direction is to the preferred direction of that oscillator, and also the animal's speed. And if you do that, you assume that the oscillators have different preferred directions, perhaps 60 degrees relative to each other, to pick a random number, then what you see is that each one actually paves the environment with these bands. And of course, the bands are at 60 degrees relative to each other. And then you can just, if you assume that somehow you can combine these bands, when you put them together, then they produce something like grid cells. And Neil Burgess has done quite a few simulations which show that it works using reasonable data. Yeah?
So can you remind me, at the start, you said there's this observation, the difference between the linear and the two-dimensional. And you said it's an important thing, people often just don't talk about it. Can you remind me now what you said? You said that in the two-dimensional version...
I was talking mostly about the place cells. And it's, but it's also true about the grid cells, to be honest. What I was saying is particularly about the directionality of the cells.
Yeah.
So that if you take a place cell and you record from it in a two-dimensional environment, let's say a square box, then it doesn't make any difference, by and large, which direction the animal runs through the place field.
Right.
So you can run north, you can run south, you can run east, you can run west, and there are slight asymmetries, but in fact, in general, the firing rate is about the same, and the field is about the same, although I must say that sometimes if you look very carefully, the fields are slightly offset relative to each other. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you look now at a linear track, by and large, and the animal's running on the linear track, what appears to happen, and I think this is probably correct, when the animal first starts running on the linear track, then the and Mike has more data on this than we do, but it's just been actually looked at very carefully in Boosman Jones. When the animal runs the first couple of trials up and down the linear track, the cell fires in both directions, but then very quickly it stops firing in both directions. And we just don't understand exactly what that phenomenon is. Well, I don't understand that. In terms of the grid cells, you see the grid pattern, of course, very nicely in a two-dimensional environment. And the cells can be either directional or non-directional, depending on where you record from in the internal cortex. How that maps onto the firing of this cell on a linear track is still an open question. Tank thinks he knows how to, as it were, project, because all of his work is done on a linear track, as is all of our work in the virtual reality. And he thinks he knows that you can actually take, for example, you can assume that when the animal's running on a linear track, it's essentially running through a slice of a two-dimensional grid pattern. I'm not convinced. I'm certainly not convinced. And so what you see is you don't see, for example, very rarely do you see a cell go brup, 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 brup on the linear track. What it goes is brup, nothing, brup, and things like that. And you have to assume that actually you're making slices which don't respect the actual...
You don't believe that there's straight lines in this
projection? I don't believe that it's a simple straight line.
Wait,
and,
it's not straight or it's not through one of the principal axes? It's straight, right?
Sorry? So what you could imagine is that that a linear track is just taking a slice, some random slice through this thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's a random slice. It's still straight. It's just...
It's straight. Yeah, it is straight, yeah. And,
but that's pretty easy to do statistics, right? If you have a random
we don't have enough data usually to do statistics. So this is just, so this was really for him to try and justify the fact that he's, he's trying to look at grid cells in an environment which is not really.
How many grid cells do you have in a linear track so far?
With more than two fields.
So we haven't done a lot of the stuff on the linear track. So in his database, he's got like maybe, I think it was 20, 25.
Oh, that's not
two
cells.
Is that enough?
With more than two place fields?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Throw down 25 random things. Yeah, that's definitely enough.
Well, so the way to do it is to actually, try to make the case, and the difficult case to make is if you record it from several cells at the same time.
He said some cells are directional.
Well, I think it's
and then try to say how would you get the patterns that you get on the assumption that you're recording from neighboring grids, and what we know about neighboring grids in this two-dimensional environment.
So the directionality is the one that's difficult, right? That when Tank measured it and Moser measured that, as well as your data in N2Rhino, the cells are not directional along linear track, meaning they fire pretty much equally at the same place in both directions on linear track.
Yeah, but
so whatever cut is being taken is the same cut in both directions.
Yep. Yeah.
Whereas CA1 place cells,
they are.
But but what when we looked at it, actually 50% of CA1 cells are bidirectional.
In the linear track.
In linear track.
Yeah, that's just you have different data from everybody else, Mayank.
I don't think so. I think that is exactly this data.
But there's this study that shows that the amount of directionality that you see depends on how many cues you
track. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Exactly.
So you
that's
I think depending.
Yeah, but
exactly.
Yeah, but even if you put lots and lots of cues on it, and of course that totally changes the animal's behavior and everything.
Yes.
It still doesn't come anywhere near close to 50%. I don't think.
No, that's what Battaglia and McNaughton also showed, and they had only four cues on the track, not lots. The behavior was the same. Actually, they compared behavior without cues and with behavior, with cues.
So why is that? So why does that make a difference? What?
Because
what?
The proximal cues are driving cells. That's the hypothesis.
Yeah.
They put proximal cues and more cells become active, and they are bidirectional.
Okay.
But it is correct that the proportion of directional cells varies a lot across labs. So there's no doubt about that. In
yeah.
some labs, it's very high.
Yeah.
Over 50% even occasionally, and in other labs it's very low. So, and I,
yeah, and
it's one of those things.
I prefer that they were all non-directional. I hate the idea that they cells stop firing in one direction. We've tried that, haven't been able to get them to come back and be bi-directional. By the way, by putting all sorts of things. Once they become directional, it seems like they are stuck in that direction.
Why is this not just a contextual remapping like any other? So the rat learns that a black box is different from a white box, and 50% of the pair cells remap, and the good cells shift almost imperceptibly.
Well, what's the conceptual? What's the context shift?
The context shift is running that way versus running that way.
Yes.
So because you've taken an environment and you've naturally created two discriminable situations for the rat,
yeah, but why doesn't that happen? So the question is why? Yeah, I agree, but why doesn't that happen in a two-dimensional environment?
Because it doesn't easily parse into two environments.
Yeah, you haven't split it into going that way versus going this way. In fact, I think if you do force a rat in an open environment, so you have a stereotype.
Yeah,
that
does happen.
Yeah,
that's right.
So presumably the system is trying to isolate discriminable situations.
Mm-hmm.
Can we then predict that fewer cues would make it less likely to be in the direction? Fewer cues you have, more likely to be bidirectional.
Sorry, the fewer cues you have.
Fewer cues. So if you want it so few cues that forget which context it is, that's when you see bidirectionality.
Well, then you get these
distant
cells.
Yeah, then you get distant cells.
That's
a separate story.
Yeah.
Then the cells stop responding to place, they start responding to distance.
So you're saying that the experimental observation is if you get more cues, then you're more likely to get bidirectional cells.
Yes.
Because more cues you have, the more they know it's.
But also depends on what kind of cues.
Semester cues?
Proximal or local cues?
How about it at the campus?
It's all this data, right? It's all these observations keep getting in the way of the ideas. Okay, so we've spent quite a bit of time, there's several people in the lab, mostly Caswell, Barry, trying to see whether some of the things that come out of this idea, that changes in frequency of either the firing, the oscillatory activity of the cells, or the theta activity, can actually relate to some aspect of the grid cells. And particularly, the model predicts that as you change the frequency of one of these oscillators, that should affect, for example, the spacing of the grids. And there are several observations which, so it's a productive model. It actually makes predictions and it says what kind of experiments you should do. So one of the nicest ones is this observation by Caswell Barry, that if you record from the grids in a familiar environment, then what you get is what the Moseys have always reported, is that the grids are stable and they stay, and the actual scale of the grid stays stable across trials. But that if you place the animal in between these recordings in a familiar environment, you place it into a novel environment, which is a similar shaped box but with different colors and smells and things like that, that it produces a very, very profound effect on the grid structure. First of all, the grids become a little bit messier, but most importantly, what happens is that the scale increases. So that if you look here, what you see is that here's a grid produced in this familiar box. Here's the same grid produced in another trial, several trials later in the same box. But in between, if you put the animal into this unfamiliar environment, what you see is that the scale expands in the new environment. So that tells us, and that what happens then is that slowly, and the expansion is quite a large change, and then over successive trials, as this new box becomes familiar, the scale regresses back to the original canonical size.
What's the percentage change?
Hmm? It varies from one animal to the other.
Yes, we can see it on the one on the left. There.
Yeah. It can be as high as 40%. It can be as high as 40%. It can be as low as 10%. It varies from one animal to the other. But over time, it slowly comes back to the original. And that happens within a day, and it happens across days. So Caswell, and I guess I agree to some extent, although I'm still a little skeptical about this, because I really do like the idea that the grids are providing some sort of universal metric. Caswell thinks that this, and Neil Burgess also think that this is acting as a kind of a familiarity signal, so that the change in the scale of the grids, and as I'll show you in a second, the change in the LFP that's recorded at the same time are actually reflecting the novelty or the familiarity of the environment. This is a little uncomfortable because we would really like this not to happen.
Is the change in scale discrete or continuous? So if as the animal gets more familiar, does the scale shrink steadily or does it jump back from the top to the bottom?
Well, yeah, question. It looks continuous, but given that, given what we know about the grids and the quantization of it,
exactly.
We don't think that there's enough data to be able to separate between those two possibilities. So it might go in quantum. We probably have the data, Kat has the data, but we haven't addressed that question. It's a good question. And as interestingly enough, for the relationship between the grid cells and the play cells, concomitant with that expansion, as shown here, you get a relay cell. Okay, so in the original familiar environment, here's a cell that fires in the south here, and then in this new environment, it remaps, and then slowly reverts over time. I don't think there's enough data to say that it reverts back to the original play cell representation. And
how does this fit with Wilson and Norton's observation that the novel element, the play cells actually grow? Isn't that? It's like 1993, the first this big multi-electrode recording paper where they claim.
So that's that's really not comparable. I think when people write about novel and familiar environments, you have to read the paper very, very carefully to see exactly what they're talking about. And my understanding is that, for example, and Stefan, you can tell me about this. In what counts as a novel in a familiar environment in the Moser lab might not necessarily be a box that the animal's never seen before. Whereas we're talking about, when we talk about a novel, this is a situation that the animal's never, ever seen before.
They did some studies, early on where they just switched between two environments.
Yes.
So they were both somewhat familiar.
Yes.
And there you don't see the expansion.
Yes, that's right. That the original idea was that you didn't, or they were relatively familiar, relatively novel. In the McNaughton and Wilson study, what they did was they had a box which the animal was originally confined to one half of the box, and then they just removed the partition so that the animal. But that's a situation in which the animal really, it's not totally novel. The animal has really got a lot of the same information, the same cues. But by the way, there is a slight expansion of the in this. That's what you're asking. There is a slight expansion in the place field size in this experiment as well. And as the model would predict, At the same time, as there's this change in the scale of the grids, there's a change in the LFP LFP frequency, and you can see here in the familiar environment, it's the firing frequency is about 8.89 hertz, whereas in the novel environment, it reduces to about 8.4, 8.5. Yeah.
What was the usual phase of firing of the precepts compared to theta?
So these are, so of course, that's a hard question because these are done in two-dimensional environments. Mm-hmm. And I think I made it clear that a lot of the work on phase is done in a single linear tract of one-dimensional environment. It occurs in two-dimensional environments, but it's much more difficult to extract the phase relationship. So I don't know the answer to that question. In a novel environment, Colin Lever has shown that there is a shift in preferred phase of the place cells. They fire earlier on phase than they do in the old one. But it's not easy to get good, reliable data in those experiments.
Now, in this LFP chain that you see across phase,
yep. Oh, these are cross trials.
Across trials.
Yeah. These are cross trials. It's small, but it's about the right.
Fine.
It's about
but
the right.
Was it controlled? The running speed was controlled.
Yeah. Or, yeah.
So it was not that novel environment. The animal was just slow.
Yeah. Yeah. We're pretty. We usually subsample the data to equate the running speed. It's an obvious thing you have to worry about, and certainly when you put the animal into a new environment, there are differences. But we always take that into account. And this occurs in the cells as well. So you can look at grid cells and show there's a correlation between the frequency, intrinsic firing frequency, and the grid cell scale. So the relationships actually seem to hold up, at least on the cells. I was going to talk a little bit about Stefan's work, but I'm going to let him talk about it, since he's going to give us. But it's another demonstration that the LFP activity in the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex seems to be, it's all correlational stuff, but it seems to have some vital role in the construction of the grid representations. Yeah?
We go back to the previous slide.
Yeah.
So there is a correlation. Is the slope of this correlation compatible with what the model would predict?
I'm not sure that we've looked back carefully at the details of it. So there's obviously, as you can see, there's a correlation, but whether how good these things will fit in a quantitative way.
General, but even qualitatively, the magnitude of the change in the frequency.
Yes, the magnitude. Yes, so qualitatively, yes. But I'm certainly not holding forth the idea that this is going to hold at an exact quantitative level. It's not physics. So what Stefan and Koenig and colleagues did was they showed that if you block septal, the medial septum, which of course is the source of many of the inputs into the hippocampus, as I said yesterday, which provide, say, the cholinergic drive, which produces these beta oscillations, you can really knock down the power of theta in both the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex. And what that does is it knocks out the grid cell pattern. And I'll leave Stefan to tell you a lot more about this. It just disintegrates. And you can show this by looking at the gridness score here. It also knocks the firing rate down a little bit. This is a short-term lidocaine block, which is, 10, 15 minutes worth of block. Interestingly enough, and this is evidence, I think, which is pretty good evidence that the place cells are not totally dependent on the grid cell. But interestingly, at the same time, there's some effect, but very, very much less of an effect on the place cells.
Have you done behavioral experiments during lidocaine block? See if there are deficits?
Yeah, there's a whole history of looking at the effect of blocking lidocaine, and it does look as though it has an effect on some aspects of spatial learning and spatial memory, but it's not clear. So that That's part of it. It's a very, very messy literature, and you should address this more towards Stefan, but it's a really messy literature of in terms of what it does affect in terms of spatial behavior and spatial memory and what it doesn't affect. And I suspect that it's the beginnings, and we think that it's the beginnings of dissecting out the various strategies that animals can use to address the spatial system. In other words, if you could produce pure environmental navigation tasks as opposed to internal path integration navigation tasks, I think you begin to see some sense of this. And I suspect, I don't know what Stefan thinks about this, he'll tell you, we would say that if you do this data block, then you're going to knock out the path integration system and you're going to leave, say, place recognition. So that animal looks around and says, oh, I know where I am because I can see the cues. But if he has to actually navigate using some sort of path integration system, then he won't.
Has there been any attempts to mode lock the theta rhythm? That is, if you put the head of the rat under an AC external potential with 10 hertz or whatever it is, it possible to mode lock the theta rhythm?
I think you'd have trouble getting it published. It's probably an interesting experiment. You'd probably have trouble getting it published and convincing people that it was the theta that you were affecting and not the rest of the brain.
Yeah. I'll be talking about, you can do it optogenetically.
That's the way to do it,
Because then you could shift systematically the theta rhythm and see.
Yeah. Or change the frequency.
Yeah, exactly.
It is surprising. Another thing I've been resistant to is the idea that you could use optogenetics to change, in some meaningful way, the frequency of these potentials. Because it is a complicated system. We call these big, nice oscillations, but when you look into the physiology of it, it's actually rather complicated as to what's happening at the single cell level. The other thing that I think is important is that, you'll allow me to call these boundary cells?
Of course.
That's what I
I noticed it's not along the border, is it? These boundary cells are also survive. So it's a very, very nice observation. I think very, very important. Thank you, to be congratulated. Okay, let me spend the last couple of minutes telling you about what I just suggested earlier yesterday. To give you some idea of how we think, at least one way of interpreting the grid cell phenomenon should be looked at. So if you think of the idea that there are these plane waves, or that any grid pattern, canonical grid pattern, can be decomposed into a series of using two-dimensional Fourier spectral analysis into sets of plane waves and represented by this spatial, this 2D Fourier spectrum here, then it suggests that, so this is a standard thing where the, let me see if I get this right, it's shown here, the actual location of these colored dots here represents the angle represents the direction of the plane wave. So this one is represented by this. The distance from the center represents the frequency of the plane wave, and the color represents the actual power wave. So, for example, a standard grid cell would be represented by this kind of a plot, showing that there are three different components, three different spectral components at about 60 degrees relative to each other. That suggests that you might then go and look at other cells, because the grid cell is only a small part, as I'll show you, a small percentage of the cells in the entorhinal cortex. It suggests that there may be other cells there which don't show the nice grid pattern, but which could be also similarly decomposed by using this analysis. And so Julia Krupic undertook that. And in fact, this was her idea, and she undertook that analysis. So in addition to grid cells, as shown here, she saw, and particularly in the parasubicular area, she saw a whole bunch of cells which are spatially periodic, but really aren't grid cells. So if you look at the grid scores here, and usually anything about 1.23 is a very good grid pattern, and it reflects how symmetrical and hexagonal this distribution is here, and how easy it is to fit a template onto it. These cells, they show some sort of nice patterns, but they're clearly not set out in this hexagonal array. And their grid scores are pretty lousy. They're way down below anything that you'd expect for a respectable grid cell. They are stable. So from one trial to the next, they show a nice repeatable pattern. And some of them look like they're more stripy and more oriented in one direction, reflecting, and this is easy to see in the autocorrelogram, suggesting that they're composed of primarily one of these Fourier components, and that it dominates the pattern more than the rest. And if you do look at the spectral analysis, you see this very nice three-component spectral analysis for the grids. But if you look at these other ones, then although they might have the same number of components, they're sometimes dominated by one component, and they are not necessarily showing this symmetrical pattern, but sometimes they're elongated. And some of them show really only two dominant components, as you'd expect from just looking at this data. And then, of course, there are a lot of other cells which just are cracked. They're not really doing anything.
Do you know the fraction of these three?
Yeah, I'll show you. I'll show you at least some analysis of it. So if you look at the grid cells and you ask how many components they have, then most of them, as you'd expect, have three components. There are a few that sneak in here with either two or four. But these other ones show a much wider distribution of components. They certainly, some of them have three components, but some of them have only one, and some have two, and some have four. In terms of the proportion, it turns out that if you take both the grids and these spatially periodic cells together as a class, they account for a large percentage, 70% of all the cells that are recorded in this particular area, the parasympathetic and the entorhinal cortex. And in fact, these non-grid spatially periodic cells are more dominant. There's 43% of the cells are in that class, and only 35% are in the grids. So we're thinking, now I should say, that the grids are special. They're more stable. So if you look either within a day or across days in terms of the stability, you see that the grids show a higher correlation between the patterns across the trials than these non-grid cells here. But you can see they're really quite respectable in terms of their stability across. And of course, they're both much better than these junk cells, as I call them. And that's either within the session or across days. And that's partly because of the stability of the Fourier components. The components are pretty stable. We think they may be just one big class of cells, and that there's something special about the stability of the grid cells, but we think that these other cells could probably do all of the work, as you'd expect the minute you start going into the Fourier domain. They could do all of the work that we're asking the grid cells to do. And one or two rather interesting observations that Yulia made really are suggestive of that. Sometimes you see cells change from one day to the next, and we're pretty sure, we're never absolutely sure you're the same cell, we're pretty sure they're the same cell, from a grid cell to one of these non-grid cells. And if you do the Fourier spectral analysis, what it looks like is that what you've done is you've maintained one of the components, one of the plane waves, and you've lost the other two. And that occurs spontaneously, but it also occurs when you switch between environments that, as it were, forces this change. So we think it may be the case that these are really all just one part of a big complex of cells. Another thing is that if you look at the components in the same animal, what you see is that, as you'd expect in the black, shown black here, the grid cells all have very similar components. They all can be composed into the same three dominant Fourier components. But if you look at these other ones, they show a very strong similarity in the components to which they can be decomposed as well. It's shown, for example, here. As you can see, there's a kind of a rough relationship between the three grid cell components here and the three red ones here. They do, however, have a much broader relationship in terms of the angles between them. The grid cells tend to have a 60-degree separation between them, whereas these have a much broader spectrum. So the story isn't complete, but there is at least the suggestion there that what you're looking at is a system which is actually providing the Fourier components. Sometimes they come together to make this very nice grid pattern, and there's probably something very special about that. I'm certainly not trying to diss the grid cells. There's something very important about it. But that many of the things that we assume they can do, for example, summing together to produce grid cells, could be done by these other cells equally well. Okay, I've run over time, but there are a lot of problems with wave interference theory or the oscillatory interference model. I think you've heard most of them, and maybe Mayak will think of a few more to throw at it in the next couple of weeks. But it certainly is very suggestive. It gives a role to the theta oscillations. And most theories, for example, none of the attractor networks give very much of a crucial role to it. They just say, oh, it's there, so maybe it has some effect on some aspect of another. But there's no intrinsic reason for this system, which this is not something you see in lots and lots of parts of the brain. This system looks like it's built to actually produce those oscillations. As you can see from the slides from Stefan's experiment, there's a whole part of the brain, the medial septum, which is there to produce those oscillations. So it needs to have a function, and it certainly provides at least one possible function for it. So if you use the speed modulation of one frequency, you turn these into the VCONs, voltage control oscillators, then that helps to explain changes in spatial scale. It makes it very easy to change spatial scale by just changing the oscillators. And you can show how it works in two dimensions. And lastly, the grid cells may be, and probably are very important, but they may be only one type of cell in the entorhinal cortex which uses this type of system. And finally, Neil Burgess and Caswell have done most of the computational work. Caswell has done a lot of very nice experimental work on what happens to grid cells in novel environments. He's also looked at the effect of changing the aspect ratio of boxes on the grid structure. And Yulia has also been doing that. And one of the things that she's been showing is that the even within a single environment, the scale of the grids can be modified by changing the shape of the box. So we're beginning to appreciate how important the actual shapes of the box are in constructing that grid pattern are. I think something which was underappreciated into that. And Yulia was the one who came up with the idea of actually using two-dimensional Fourier spectral analysis to decompose effect. Thank you for your attention. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question about this moving backwards. So if all this theory that if you move backwards, then you get phase precession instead of phase precession.
It's
sort of like yeah. So we had to have some way to prevent it from happening. We had to somehow some additional rule to say that you cannot recruit oscillator that
changes in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
You can just put it in by hand. But it certainly is true. So we've done it in virtual reality. Just a quick look, you can run the animal very easily backwards. But it's been done in the Collège de France lab, and by having animals run on a cart where they're running, the cart is going in the opposite direction that they're running, and things like that. And phase precession always goes in the same direction. So the voltage controlled oscillator always increases and never decreases below the baseline oscillator. If that's what we're looking at, so you're absolutely right. You need to have some way in which you prevent it from going.
And that's the thing. I was talking to this guy Zugaro's lab.
Yeah.
And they also see the placeville asymmetry flip.
Yeah.
And it goes backward, the asymmetry two flips.
Yeah.
So what do you think of that?
I think whether the field is symmetrical or not.
No, field is asymmetric.
Yeah.
When it's going forward, the asymmetry is this way.
Yeah.
And the precession is going this way.
Yeah.
When it goes backward, the asymmetry flips and precession flips.
Yeah. I think whether you see symmetrical or asymmetrical fields varies again a lot. I mean, in general we see symmetrical fields. Depends on how you define the field and things like that. They tended to define the field a lot closer to the way you define it. When I looked at their data, I got the impression that they were less asymmetrical than they were saying that they were. How does the external examiner?
The difference is basically on the threshold, right?
Yes,
you have an asymmetric distribution.
Yeah. It depends on how long the tail
is. Asymmetry is going to go down.
It depends on how you define a place for and what you're going to do with all of those spikes which you're firing randomly or not so randomly. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask about how you think about noise in the system.
I'm not a computational neuroscientist.
Okay,
I don't think of noise. Noise doesn't exist in my world.
Okay. Let me try to explain what seems to me to be a difficulty with these models, and I want to understand how you think about how this could be resolved. So if you look at the theta oscillation, it's really not a pure sine wave.
No.
And if you would follow its phase in time, it could kind of wander around relative to what it would be if it was a pure sine, right?
So it depends on what we're talking about. Are you talking about the internal membrane potential oscillations?
Well, I'm talking about LFP because that's something that we can measure. I can't
measure. Well, yes, okay.
Okay, so empirically, it's not a phase that just increases with time linearly, it wanders around and does stuff. Now in the model, you need to have another oscillation which its own phase changes relative to the first one, but it has to do so in a coordinated manner, because otherwise the whole thing won't work.
Yes.
Do you have some more specific thoughts about mechanism? What could give rise to these two different oscillations which are noisy? Each one of them is noisy, but they're somehow coordinated in a very special manner, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. So if you assume, as we mentioned earlier, that they're always there, but they're 180 degrees out of each other, even if they're noisy, that there's some...
But they're not just 180 degrees, because you have one oscillation which is, say, not modulated by velocity, and the other one is modulated by velocity, so its phase relative to the first one is constantly changing. Right. In response to motion. But nevertheless, the first one is noisy, so the second one has to be
equally noisy.
Equally noisy, but in the same manner.
But still be influenced by speed, whereas the other one doesn't get influenced by speed. I think that's his question. How can you do both?
You can phase lock them, but if you phase lock them too tightly, you can't make them out.
The same problem as you've got
and if you phase lock them too weakly, then they get
the
phase
by
noise.
Let me rephrase this question as a statement. This is incredibly fragile.
Yeah.
It's so fragile that it stretches the imagination.
Don't hold back.
It depends on how correlated the noise and the frequencies are. If the noise and the frequencies are correlated, like up until, I don't know, like 0.4, 0.5, which could be feasible if it's the same theta rhythm going to the soma and also a dendrite, and then that dendrite somehow increases its frequency. So you can think of some sort of correlation going on because the initial theta feeding to both are the same. So as long as that correlation...
I think the point he's making is that then how would you get one guy to depend on speed and the other to be not dependent on speed?
Well, that, I can imagine a ramp.
Sure, you can think of lots of ways in which you can do that. You've got two things like this, and one of them is gated by speed, and one of them isn't.
The initial reason has to be right, and the antidote has to be right for these three oscillators all to be in sync. I mean, it's.
So which model are you talking about? You're talking about the place cell model or the
grid cells?
For grid cells, it's trickier because you have to have constant coherence.
I agree with you here.
Yeah.
I mean, has anybody, for instance, built a network model of this? I mean, it seems like this is begging. You know enough now that should be doable, right? Because it seems it's going to be hard.
It's going to be hard no matter what you do. I mean, a network model is going to be hard as well, for all the reasons we heard.
I think Hasselmoor has built network models that perform oscillatory interference. So.
It gets better if you put the oscillators into networks and have them support each other, then it gets better. I think the problem is that we know that there are these internal intracellular membrane potentials, and that they're moving outside of the overall field potential, which must represent some summation of the oscillatory behavior of lots and lots of cells. So you can ignore that, but it turns out that that's driving the cell. That actually is driving the cell. It's a signal which is a combined depolarization, as was shown, and that's certainly true. But that it's on top of that depolarization is an oscillation.
But if you get rid of the oscillation, you'd have depolarization, you'd have spikes, and everything would work out pretty well. You'd see tight fields and good fields, and everything would be fine.
Yeah, just like, well, we could get rid of all of the phenomena.
Now you're talking my language.
But then you wouldn't have to explain it, right?
No, but there's still a problem.
These are observations. So that's what we're trying to explain is what.
There's no compelling evidence that the oscillations are important for anything, right?
For anything.
Mm-hmm. Are they?
There's all the intracellular data, and we have some similar data, which is that they're actually driving this spike.
If you take them away, the spikes go away.
It's not clear how you do it.
You can take oscillations away, depolarize a little bit, and everything will work out just fine, right? You get the same.
I doubt it. I don't.
I mean, Stefan's experiment showed that when you block theta oscillation, cells still spike. And C even place cells at decent place fields too, right? So those things work out.
But they don't show the grid field.
Yes.
So that's what we're trying to explain. What's the relationship?
Sorry, I missed that. What's the relationship for that?
Well, I said he didn't say it.
why don't you tell?
suggests that the place fields don't depend on oscillatory interference. That's
Does the phase precession persist for the place fields after you do this block?
There's no theta, there's nothing to process.
So what happens if the red moves past the place field if you block the theta rhythm?
Place field persists.
The place field persists.
But do you get bursting in the cells?
Yeah.
What happens with the firing of that particular cell?
The theta modulation of the cell decreases substantially.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there's enough remaining to test this.
What about the spiking autocorrelation?
Decreases, but the cells still stay, some cells stay theta modulated. I should also say, you saw from the figure that the theta doesn't go to zero, it goes to 20%, 30%, so there might be, it's actually on our to-do list of analysis that we want to do in the lab on the data we already acquired to look at that. We actually have now, we repeated this experiment, we reproduced our data with Massimol instead of lidocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a main advantage with Massimol is that it does not have as much of an effect on firing rate. So the firing rate of the place cells is actually not reduced. So now with these new data, we can actually do this analysis much more effectively. Because in the other data, the decrease in firing rate would actually be a major confound in doing the analysis. So I don't know the answer to this yet.
How would you explain any phenomenon? How would you explain those sort of things?
Which phenomenon?
Well, say, all say, yeah, knocking well,
knocking out data.
Knocking out data. Have no
effect. So wait, knocking out data has no effect on animals?
No, it should. That's presumably.
No, look, I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying I don't see any super compelling evidence that it's important for behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's important for behavior. Right. Believe me, I it's so ubiquitous, but. the evidence really isn't, if you think about it, that compelling. There's lots of evidence that's involved in stuff.
Yes.
But knocking out with that kind of other things, of course, is really hard, right? But,
yeah, well, yeah,
that's the problem.
You knock out is that just the cholinergic input.
So,
right.
So that is really
the
old
Winston experiment.
We don't know that it's the oscillatory component of that, and not just the cholinergic component.
Yeah, so knocking out the cholinergic component really knocks the amplitude of the wave down, but they're still there. I think Stephen's point is a very good one, just to knock the amplitude down. So the oscillatory, the ACH input actually is some sort of thing. But you can still have oscillations at the cellular level without having this big signature.
Okay, so but I think this is key, you know, that the oscillations persist to some degree, but they're no longer coordinated.
Yes.
You know, so
yes.
Because they're not coordinated, you don't see a signal in extracellular space anymore. So I think that's
coordinated means losing phase coherence. That's what you mean, but not
yeah.
coordinated.
Well, in these recordings, if you look at the pyramidal cells, you know, they individually they show state of modulation. But my assumption is that we haven't explicitly tested that. My assumption is, you know, that there's less synchrony between the
mm-hmm.
between
yeah.
the individual cells, and that, you know, that reduces the signal that you record, you know, the population signal that you record as an LFP.
So that will certainly spoil and a wave interference interpretation if you could still do place cell location.
No, only the half of it which. Suggested.
Yeah.
So the general idea.
It would support you. If that destroys the grid cells, which I understand it does, right?
Yeah.
Then that would support your grid cell superposition because apparently it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
But the place cell
yeah.
seems to still work. It
yeah.
suggested something else.
Yeah. Well, as I suggested yesterday, there are really two ways to create a place cell.
Yeah.
But the place cell.
That's why
share.
I pointed out that the boundary. Vector cells, if you want to call them, out of the boundary cells, the ones that fire in this like a slab from a distance from the wall, are still there. So they're still there to provide that information. So you can have this model where there are two independent ways to do signals.
But you showed that, some of your pictures showed that if you knock out the grid cells, the place cells are still there, but
yep.
they were in a slightly different position, as if somehow the grid cells contributed to what they were doing, but
they're not.
You had some pictures.
There were
different cells.
The upper lobe plots.
No,
those
were two different
cells.
That was
novel versus.
Okay, sorry. I didn't describe both cells.
Yeah. Okay. So those are different. So an individual cell didn't shift position, place cell, with the knockout of data.
Well, that's. Definitely.
No, they don't shift their position. So that, I mean, you can show this analytically, you know, that there's no more difference than in a control experiment. So
if one of the oscillator changes its speed dependence, let's say LFP, we know theta, LFP theta does depend on running speed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if that dependence is destroyed, would the interference model predict phase precession will change or not?
Yes, I'm sure it would, yeah.
So unfortunately, we didn't find that.
Yeah.
So in virtual reality, we saw...
We just don't agree with your
we have data. I mean, it's not interpretation, yeah. It's numbers from 2,000 cells. You see, when
speed
you get dependence...
Speed theta, you
right, so speed dependence of theta, frequency is gone. Phase precession, zero significant.
Okay, but this is
speed dependence of.
No, I'm just asking. Is it a bit?
No, but this. So this is speed dependence of LFP.
LFP theta frequency.
Yeah. So because the speed dependence of the spiking still has to be there.
That's why I was asking John whether the speed dependence of LFP theta frequency makes a difference.
So it's the difference between the two frequencies that's important.
Yes. So one of them is speed dependent. Let's say
they're both speed dependent.
But yes, so
but as long as they have a different gate.
But in fact,
that's more likely because one
yes.
does see changes.
Yes,
the fact that you see change, a speed dependent change in the extracellular LFP means that what you're assuming is that they're both changing the spiking speed tendency is changing faster.
See, the spiking is a result of everything, right? When you measure the spiking of a cell, no matter which model you're talking about, the spiking is the result of all kinds of oscillators, attractors, everything. It's the net output.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, if there is phase precession as a function of position, by definition, it is speed dependent. So that's not saying too much. What matters is the ingredients. The ingredients are two. One ingredient that everybody uses, the local field potential. And we interpret the whichever way we want. That local field potential is the clock with respect to which everything is calculated.
Yeah.
That local field potential frequency depends on running speed.
Yeah.
And lots of people have shown that. We see that too in the real world.
Yeah.
In virtual reality, the speed dependence of the clock is abolished. Still, the spiking output in terms of precession is identical. Now, there's this big unknown, the other thing. Dendrite, network, whatever else it is, membrane potential, we don't know. But my question is this, that no matter who does this experiment, LFP is the clock. LFP speed frequency changes with speed in the real world,
mm-hmm.
in everybody's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody sees phase precession in the real world. The major change we see is that in the virtual world, phase precession is intact. The speed dependence of the LFP clock is gone, and still precession is intact. And I find that a little mysterious to reconcile with this.
I agree that the difference is important. And I, you know, we have data now, and we artificially drive data. We can actually drive it to, let's say, 10 hertz instead of 8 hertz.
Yeah.
And phase precession remains intact. Even
so, where is that other source of oscillators? Shouldn't the other oscillator still care for 8 hertz? Why would it go now at 10 hertz if there is another oscillator?
If we had the other oscillator, then the whole thing would be a lot easier, because then we could actually... The problem is we can only see one oscillator.
But I'm saying...
We can see the spike in the cell, so we have to infer.
Yeah.
But that's the hypothesis, right? The other oscillator has a certain natural tendency to go at 8 hertz.
So it's the difference between the oscillators. So the fact whether the cells also shift is actually 2 hertz.
Okay. Well, it will
depend to some extent on where you are on the curve.
Yeah.
So you could set that to zero dependency, yes, and then as long as the second oscillator changes in the right way.
So the second oscillator has to, now going back to the discussion we were having earlier, that other oscillator or something, whatever you call, has to now keep track of whatever the LFP is doing. In one case, the LFP is changing with speed, then the other guy has to go even faster. In the other case, in our virtual reality, when the LFP doesn't have speed dependence, then this guy has to slow down.
That's right. You got to model, that's it.
Then you drive the so-called one oscillator by Stefan's method at arbitrary frequency.
Whatever frequency.
The clock signal, right?
Yeah.
That clock now is changed from 8 hertz to something else.
Yeah.
And still the other oscillator keeps track of it, which means that the other oscillator has none of its own internal dynamics. It just follows whatever is out there with some speed.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understand biophysics...
Plus a space-dependent offset.
Yeah, plus a space-dependent offset. So how would that work, that the other oscillator will keep track of it at all frequencies and at all kinds of speed dependence and all kinds of... I find that that's a mystery that I'm trying to grapple with.
Lots
of
people
want to
ask why.
No, why is God made it? So let's say, why, I don't care. As long as we can understand by a physical mechanism,
how
God being
when
gone, peace, so that's fine.
Why questions?
Why is it? It's a good question, but we can't answer.
We can ask maybe.
But I think that's the question. So
it's an easy way to make the system work. You change the difference between the few.
No,
it's easy to change the scale of the system.
But why phase precession?
It has a very powerful global...
No, phase precession. So what's phase precession seems unnecessary to me. What do you get out of that?
I'm talking about my mother here.
Anything
is not saying, why do we care about places?
What's
the first thing Neil Brody said to me?
I don't need place cells. I can make the whole thing work without them.
In fact, it's almost the end of a beautiful romance.
They'll be moving into the same building.
Well, you're director. Maybe I want you.
The idea is that if there is phase precession, then you can learn temporal sequences. That's a key reason. Because if place fields are this big, an STDP cares for 50 milliseconds, then the whole thing is not going to work with Poisson rate modulated Poisson process. What you need is temporal sequence compression. In phase precession, we'll achieve this, and several people have shown. So that's the key thing. Unless you find a way to make NMDA dependent plasticity 1 second wide, then you got, that's not going to work. So that 50 milliseconds. So you need that. And strictly speaking, you don't even need phase precession. Strictly speaking, you don't even
going.
All you need is precise timing, right? Between two neurons. Relevant pairs of neurons should fire at same timing. It doesn't have to be periodic. Periodicity is a nice way to achieve it many times. When we have LTP experiment, you want that precise pairing to occur multiple times.
So you don't need either oscillation to phase precession for...
No, you need low frequency correlated noise. That's enough. But nature
so
may achieve
it. You want to produce LTP. Sorry, is that what you're going to
do? No, I mean, that's the rationale for phase precession is LTP.
That's right. NMDA dependent LTP of all kind, one particular kind. And that's, yeah.
It's one possible rationale.
That's right.
They're good possible.
Phenomena I agree with. I mean, everybody observes it, but computationally,
there is one. The only one I can think of, and many others that I'm not aware of.
You also sort of in the altitude. So if you have a bunch of velocity modulated oscillators and cosine tuning, you put them together, whenever you get a big peak, the expression is always there. You can prove that. Which is inevitable in that sense.
But see, again, there I will bring back my favorite thing, noise. If there is substantial amount of noise, will that always happen?
Yeah,
absolutely. So when theta means 6 to 12 hertz, that's like factor of 2 difference in frequency of period of theta, right? It's going, that's how we calculate theta, 6 to 12. So will you get this always in that case? Yeah, at least not obviously.
But I think that comes back to the question of how that second oscillator emerges,
which
we don't know. So, and it might emerge in a way so that it's actually coupled to the phase frequency. So
that's the original. The idea is that it's coupled in some way.
So then,
but again, it can be modulated independently.
Yeah. So
in the resting state, it's they're always.
So that and essentially, what my simple thinking about that is, you know, that most noise in such a system would be a common noise, you know, that's common to both frequencies. So, if the second oscillator emerges, you know, out of the same circuitry, essentially, or a shared circuitry, and I don't know what that is. So, I don't know when anyone knows, you know, how the higher oscillation frequency emerges, you know. I think the best model is probably the Geissler model that has suggested a relation between the two. So, although in my reading, the Geissler model actually predicts the opposite, you know, that the lower frequency oscillator actually emerges from the higher frequency.
That's right.
One. So
that's exactly right. All places are going at 9 hertz.
Yes.
And you add them up and you get 8 hertz.
Yes.
But that requires very precise phase synchronization when they start.
Yeah.
You said noisy networks, again, I get nervous when you require such precise synchrony.
I also have to, our data actually would suggest the opposite, because we can, manipulate the lower frequency oscillator and get the higher frequency one. So, and then also, one thing that is not always well advertised is, the degree of phase precession between different neurons is quite variable. So in the rat, most neurons are phase precessed quite well, although also at different slopes. In the mouse, actually, the fraction of phase precession cells in our hands, at least, is not nearly as high as it is in rats. So
that's why mice are stupider than rats.
Probably.
But,
So there is noise in the sense, you know, that that some cells, you know, seem to have a very, you know, a very tightly coupled behavior, you know, that, that results in phase possession, others don't. So
I think for this two oscillator thing, there are a couple of observations that I think I asked, which will be still worth figuring out. One is several people have reported precession being very nonlinear, which is abundantly demonstrated. It would be good if two oscillator model can replicate that. Other thing is the experiment you mentioned, the Zugarro-Buzaki experiment, that you shut down the activity for 200 milliseconds, precession starts exactly where it is.
Yeah.
Whereas the current version does not do that.
No, well, it's inherited from the entorhinal cortex.
Yeah, so I'm that's
sorry, the same experiment in the entorhinal cortex.
Somehow, so
that
that's right.
That would be an interesting experiment.
Yeah.
It's also pretty gross. I mean, I like Stefan's thing. So I use nothing genetics.
Yeah, with some method. Yeah.
Control, some.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to patch dendrites.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to actually look at what's going on. I mean, so all of this is indirect. It's all kind of weird, making assumptions. It's all
But while we are theories, there happens to be an alternate theory that doesn't suffer from these problems. That's the asymmetric grand theory. That can, doesn't suffer from noise issues. That can
you just need to keep adding all these other things to turn off the fire. You just have to have all these
just
things to turn off. Turn them all off so that the firing gate drops in the and the phase possession continues. I don't think there's a model which doesn't have
absolute
problems. And I don't think there's a model which is invulnerable to noise. Well, throwing noise at a particular model is right. Unless if there is, you should tell us.
My velocity free distance.
I velocity free. Any other questions?
Any
comments?
Other questions?
Yeah.
Assuming you can recall cells as spike several theta cycles successively during REM sleep, is there a phase precession?
Yes.
Mm. There's no speed.
Oh yeah, the animal thinks he's running. What he is doing, Steve, you're running away from somebody all the time. You're always running away. No, clearly the animal thinks he's running. So the whole, I mean, it's not actual speed, it's not actual movement, it's brain. It's a correlative discharge saying I'm running. Good try.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks, John.